Okay, we have only two chapters left of Deuteronomy. One of them very short, and one of them, well, not much to comment on. The longer of the two is chapter 33, and that's where we come now. It's not real long, nor is it real short, but it's really hard to know what to say about it in many cases. It's very much like Genesis 49. Now, you remember Genesis 49 was the occasion when Jacob was dying, and he called all his 12 sons into the room, and he uttered prophetic blessings, patriarchal blessings, over each son individually. And these were individual young men that were being prophesied over, but they were the progenitors, or would be the progenitors, of 12 tribes. And therefore, the things that Jacob said to them on that occasion were kind of a combination of things that related to them as individual men and things that would relate to the destiny of their tribes. So that, for example, details of their individual lives, like the cruelty of Simeon and Levi against the city of Shechem, or Reuben's going up to his father's bed, or Joseph having been separated from his brethren, and things that were part of their individual lives are alluded to in Jacob's blessings. But also in those blessings are projections of the tribes that would come from those young men and what the destinies of those tribes would be. Sometimes almost nothing was said. And sometimes things were said, but they're almost unintelligible to us because we don't know in what way they were fulfilled. You see, we have a record of the predictions, but we don't have in the historical record comprehensive accounts of what happened to each tribe. We have, for the most part, the historical records of the Old Testament focusing on the fate of the nation as a whole, without very often focusing on one tribe or another. And that means, I think, we are to assume that the things that were predicted did come true, but we don't know how they came true. We don't know what the explanation is. And we have a similar thing in chapter 33. This time Moses, just before his death, is uttering sort of like a patriarchal blessing over the tribes of Israel too. He is not their father, and they're not his sons, so it's not exactly the same thing. And also, he's not looking at 12 men, but he's looking at 12 tribes. The prophecies he makes, no doubt, are about tribal destinies, because he's not talking to individual men, but to now the tribes that have arisen out of those. Things are very different than they were when Jacob uttered his prophecies. Some of the things he says about the tribes resemble and are even identical to some of the things that Jacob said. But in general, these blessings are more positive across the board. When Jacob gave his prophecies over his sons, a few of them were positive. Certainly Joseph and Judah were given very positive prophecies, and maybe a few others that were very brief. But statements, the blessings that Jacob uttered over his sons, many of them were very negative, because his sons were bad guys. And he had some bad things to say and to predict about them. For the most part, Moses' predictions are positive. And that's strange, really, when you think about all the things Moses has said prior to this, because he's pointed out that these people are stiff-necked, stubborn, even in Moses' lifetime, and how much more after he's gone, he said. And yet, there are positive things that he can find to say about them, and he does plan, although he has not been given much encouragement about their future. He dies leaving them some occasion for encouragement. Yet, the things he predicts about each tribe, as in Jacob's blessings, often are very hard to identify with anything that we know of that happened later on. That's why I say it's a hard passage to comment on, because you read what is predicted and then you have to say, well, what this really meant in terms of its fulfillment is anyone's guess, because we don't have record of their later tribal destinies in many cases. Now, one thing that's interesting about this particular chapter is that he goes through tribe by tribe, as Jacob did, giving separate predictions for each, with the exception that Zebulun and Issachar seem to be joined together in verse 18 as having the same blessing attributed to them. But after all is said and done, something has been left unsaid, and that is, what is the fate of Simeon? Simeon is not mentioned. There are 11 tribes mentioned, but Simeon is not. No explanation is given for that. Now we know that Simeon and Levi, in Jacob's prophecy, had been implicated in the bloody deed done at Shechem, and therefore both Simeon and Levi forfeited their positions in the primogeniture of the family, so that the firstborn Reuben had been passed over from privilege of firstborn because he had committed fornication with his father's concubine. Simeon and Levi both were passed over because of their deed at Shechem. But Levi, of course, in later time, was honored because of their faithfulness to God at the incident of the golden calf. Now, in the days of Jacob, Jacob said of Simeon and Levi, both, that they would be they'd be scattered in Israel. The exact words of Jacob I probably should look up so I can represent them correctly. But about Simeon and Levi, it says in Genesis 49:7, "Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." Now, Simeon and Levi were to be divided and scattered throughout Israel. We see how that is fulfilled with Levi because they became the Levites who were, their Levitical cities, 48 cities, were divided up among the tribes. So Levi, unlike most of the tribes, didn't have a particular tribal region that Levi got, but rather they were scattered throughout Israel, but in a good way. In a way that was their privilege to represent God to the people. Now, Simeon may have been scattered in Israel also to the point where they didn't really end up with much. In the book of Joshua, it would appear that Simeon's land that was given to him was a very small portion within the territory of Judah. It's like they don't even get a separate land of their own. They just get kind of a piece of property in the middle of Judah's territory. And so they're kind of out of the picture. And the exclusion of Simeon in this case might reflect, although we can't say for sure because we're not told that it is so, but it could easily be that it reflects God's anger at Simeon because of the matters at Baal Peor. Back in Numbers chapter 25, that was when, through the evil counsel of Balaam, Balak, the king of Moab, sent women into the Israeli camp to seduce the men, not only into fornication, but into idolatry as well. And therefore, God sent a plague on the camp. And it was only Phinehas resolved to go and put an end to it by shoving a spear through a man and a woman who were having sex that ended it. But the man and the woman that were speared in this way were a man of the tribe of Simeon and a woman of Midian. Both of them were leading persons. She was the daughter of a king, as he's later called, or a prince in Midian. And the man in question was Zimri, the son of Salu, a leader of the father's house among the Simeonites. Now, that's in Numbers 25:14. It says he was a leader of a father's house in the tribe of Simeon. We also read of his sin in verse 6 of that chapter, Numbers 25:6. "Indeed, one of the children of Israel," that's Zimri, the Simeonite, "one of the children of Israel came and presented to his brethren a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the children of Israel who were weeping at the door of the tabernacle of meeting." They were weeping because a plague had come on the nation because of this very kind of action. And this leader of the tribe of Simeon, in spite of the fact that many of the people of Israel were already repenting because of the horrible plague that had taken 24,000 of them out, This man was oblivious to it, cared nothing for it, was continuing the idolatrous harlotry, and even presented this woman to his brethren. Apparently, like, let's all go into her and worship the Midianite gods in this way that they did with the sex acts and so forth. And it would appear that this man, a leader in the tribe of Simeon, was trying to seduce his whole tribe to participate with him in this act. And it may be that they did to a greater or lesser degree that we are not reading about. It may be that the tribe of Simeon had a leading role in the matter of Baal Peor, but we don't know very much about that. If it is true that they did, and it seems not unlikely given the small amount of information we do have and the role of Simeon's tribe in that, that might be why the blessing is simply left out for Simeon. Simeon is essentially ignored as part of Israel in this. Anyway, this is how the chapter goes. Now, this is the blessing with which Moses, the man of God, blessed the children of Israel before his death. And he said, Yahweh came from Sinai and dawned on them from Seir. He shone forth from Mount Paran, and he came with the 10,000s of saints. From his right hand came a fiery law for them. Now, this is referring to when God gave the law at Mount Sinai. He came with a law that is a fiery law. I don't know why it's called a fiery law. Perhaps because the violation of it would bring upon the people the fire of God's wrath. Fire, generally in the scripture, being an image of God's wrath and judgment. So the law was a law that had a bite to it. It's a fiery law. And he says he came with 10,000s of saints, and I wouldn't maybe pause to comment about that, except that that term is used in the New Testament also, of Jesus coming with 10,000s of his saints. But in those passages where we read of Jesus coming with 10,000s of his saints in the New Testament, it would seem that it is talking about his second coming. Now, that could be disputed, because certainly this is not talking about that same kind of event here, like the second coming of Christ. But the 10,000s of his saints, it has been disputed who those saints are. The word saints literally in the Hebrew means holy ones. And some scholars think it refers to the holy angels. That when God came to Mount Sinai, he came with 10,000s of his angels with him. This later worked its way into Jewish lore, so that the angels were seen as intermediaries at Mount Sinai in the giving of the law to the people of Israel. And in the New Testament writers speak as if this is a given, as if it is in fact so, that the law was given through angels. And that may be the 10,000s of his holy ones that's referred to. In Acts chapter 7, for example, when Stephen is preaching, in Stephen's sermon, he said in verse 53, he said of the people of Israel that they have received the law by the direction of angels and have not kept it. Now, that they received the law at the direction of angels is never really clearly stated in the Old Testament, but that is what the Jews had come to believe, and that was their tradition. Paul also says in Galatians 3:19 that the law was given by the mediation of angels. In Galatians 3 and verse 19 says, what purpose then does the law serve? It was added because of transgressions, till the seed should come to whom the promise was made, and it was appointed through angels by the hand of a mediator, meaning through Moses. But through angels, it says, it was appointed. And then in Hebrews chapter 2, there's also a reference to the role of angels in the giving of the law. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 2. It says, for if the word spoken through angels prove steadfast, and every transgression and disobedience received a just reward, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? So he's talking about the law of Moses. It was a word spoken through angels. So the New Testament seems to confirm that angels were involved at Mount Sinai, though we don't read of it in Exodus. We might be reading of it here, and this reference to the 10,000s of His holy ones might be a reference to 10,000s of His angels. Although the saints are mentioned in verse 3 of Deuteronomy 33, in the very next verse, and they seem to be referring to Israel. Certainly, when God came to Sinai, there were 10,000s of Israelites there too, His saints, His holy ones, the ones that He had separated to Himself and delivered. So it's not clear whether God coming with 10,000s of His saints means angels or people. But one reason I bring this up is because it is occasionally said especially by dispensationalists in proving or seeking to prove the pre-tribulational rapture doctrine, that there must be two phases of Christ's coming. Because we read in the New Testament of Jesus coming with 10,000s of His saints. But they say, if He's going to come with 10,000s of His saints, He must first come for the saints, so that they'll be with Him to come with Him. And so this is one of the 20 arguments that I used to use when I was pre-tribulational myself, because that's what they told me, and I was young, and it made sense to me. The idea is there must be two comings of Christ, the coming for His saints in the rapture, and His coming with the saints at the end of the tribulation. Of course, there's almost everything about that reasoning is flawed. For one thing, as I said, it's possible that coming with His saints is a reference to coming with angels, in which case it would have nothing to do with His coming with Christians or not. But even if it is talking about Christians, He can certainly come with His saints without there being a rapture first. There are 10,000s of His saints with Him already, Christians who've died and gone on to be with Him. It says in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 14 or 15 that when He comes, He'll bring those who sleep in Jesus with Him. So obviously there's certainly more than tens of thousands. 10,000s of His saints are already among those who sleep that He will bring with Him. He would not have to rapture one Christian from the earth in order to bring 10,000s of His saints with Him when He comes. Furthermore, even if He meant all the saints, even if the living saints would have to come with Him, there's no reason why He couldn't rapture them into the air and then immediately come with them. There's certainly no argument in this for some kind of an interval between one phase of the second coming and another. And while I don't feel like I have any axe to grind about it, it's interesting to me that that is one of the arguments used in favor of a pre-trib rapture when it's based on the assumption that when Jesus comes back, He must come with all the saints and therefore must rapture them previous to that. And for some reason, they think it must be 7 years previous to that, rather than, say, moments earlier. But in any case, since this might even be a reference to angels, it might have nothing to do at all with Jesus coming with the Christians, since the term is used ambiguously here. It is equally ambiguous in its use in the New Testament. Deuteronomy 33:3. Yes, He loves the people, all His saints. Now here it refers to the people, the saints, are in your right hand. They sit down at your feet. Everyone receives your words. Moses commanded a law for us, a heritage of the congregation of Jacob. And he was king in Jeshurun. That is, God was king in Jeshurun, not Moses. When the leaders of the people were gathered, all the tribes of Israel together. Now we start talking about the tribes individually. Most of these are very short. Joseph receives a rather long treatment, and Levi does also, but most of these are quite short. Let Reuben live and not die, nor let his men be few. That's the whole thing right there. Let the tribe of Reuben survive, and let not his men be few. Now, there's a bit of a textual problem here, because the word nor, let his men be few, the word nor is in italics, because there's no negative in the Hebrew here on this phrase. Literally, it says, let him live and not die, let his men be few. So it could be taken to mean Reuben will survive as a tribe, but not very a big tribe. It's going to be reduced to be very small. And that did happen, because the tribe of Reuben and the tribe of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh settled on the east side of the Jordan, and they were vulnerable to attacks. There were no natural defenses there as there were in Israel. And so they were among the first to go into idolatry. They were among the first to go into captivity. They were reduced to a very insignificant tribe. And therefore, it may be that he's saying, let Reuben live and not die, but his men are going to be few. On the other hand, both the New King James, and I notice also the New American Standard Version and other versions, they do include the negative here, because they apparently are assuming that the negative of the previous clause applies to both, not die and not have few men. That is, there is a word not in the phrase prior to this phrase. So let Reuben live, but not die or have few men. So it would be, you know, the idea that not only is he not to die, but he's not to have few men. The word not would apply to both clauses. And that's apparently how the translators have taken it here, because they've added on their own this negative before the last clause. Anyway, that's all on Reuben. Verse 7, he said of Judah, "Hear, Yahweh, the voice of Judah, and bring him to his people. Let his hands be sufficient for him, and may you be a help against his enemies." It's not, that's kind of generic. Basically, bless Judah, you know, and protect him against his enemies. Levi, in verse 8, and of Levi he said, "Let your Thummim and your Urim be with your Holy One, whom you tested at Massah, and with whom you contended at the waters of Meribah, who says of his father and mother, 'I have not seen them,' nor did he acknowledge his brothers or know his own children." Now, what this is a reference to is, of course, what happened at Mount Sinai when Moses said, "Who's on the Lord's side in the instant of the golden calf?" And the tribe of Levi came over to Moses. And Moses said, "Okay, take your swords and go and slaughter everyone who's worshiping the golden calf." And they killed 3,000 people, including some of their own brethren and relatives. And they were commended for this, that their zeal for God was sufficient to make them not show favoritism toward offenders just because they had blood relations with them. Now, this is probably a hyperbole when it says he didn't acknowledge his own brothers or even his parents. He acted like he didn't even know his parents. Presumably, if a Levite had found his own parents in that situation worshiping the golden calf, they would even have killed their own parents. Now, whether this literally was a fact or whether it's just in the poetry of hyperbole, the point is here that their loyalty to God exceeded their loyalty to their family members, which is exactly as it really should be. "For they observed your word and kept your covenant. They shall teach Jacob your judgments and Israel your law." This has been mentioned just in our last session, that it was the role of the Levites to possess and steward the law, essentially to teach it to the people of Israel. "And they shall put incense before you and whole burnt sacrifice on your altar. Bless his substance, Lord, and accept the work of his hands. Strike the loins of those who rise against him and of those who hate him, that they rise not again." So, once again, basically a generic blessing. Let them be blessed. Let their enemies not succeed against them, and you avenge them against their enemies. Verse 12, "Of Benjamin he said, 'The beloved of the Lord shall dwell in safety by him who shelters him all the day long, and he shall dwell between his shoulders.'" Now, "the beloved of the Lord shall dwell safely by him who shelters him all the day long" is a reference to Benjamin being beloved of the Lord and dwelling by God who will shelter him. The tribe of Benjamin actually had their property, their real estate, right next to the tribe of Judah. They were so much in proximity to Judah that when the split happened in the days of Rehoboam, 10 tribes disassociated from Judah, but Benjamin remained with Judah. Benjamin was a very small tribe at that time, very, very insignificant, but they were connected. In fact, the city of Jerusalem lay on the border of Benjamin and Judah's territory. The city of Jerusalem actually traversed the border. So it was like part in the tribe of Benjamin and part in the tribe of Judah. That's how closely associated they were with Judah. And they remained loyal to Judah after the split, and none of the other tribes did. And this may be the reason why good things are said about Benjamin. Now, in Jacob's blessing of Benjamin, it was much more ominous. I mean, this is very, very positive about Benjamin. But when Jacob spoke of Benjamin, in Genesis 49:27, it says, "Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey, and at night he will divide the spoil." And that's not really negative, except it depicts Benjamin as a fierce tribe who would be able to conquer, you know, their enemies and divide the spoil. This probably refers to such incidents as that which we read of in the end of the book of Judges, where a city of the tribe of Benjamin, Gibeah, actually committed shameful acts, and the tribes of Israel marshaled against them and told the tribe of Benjamin to surrender that city to be judged, and the tribe of Benjamin stood by that city and fought off the Israelites and almost wiped out the rest of the 12 tribes. Not almost wiped them out, but almost defeated them. Little Benjamin, fierce warriors, they fought against the other 11 tribes and almost won. However, they didn't win, and then they were reduced down to 400 men. That's tiny for a tribe, you know, 400 males. And they almost were extinct, except they went and kidnapped women from other tribes and married them, and Israel allowed them to reproduce and become a tribe again, but they almost were extinct. But that fierceness of Benjamin was something that Jacob had mentioned in his blessing of Benjamin. But here, it's more very real positive. Benjamin is the beloved of the Lord. He's sheltered by God. He actually dwells safely by him, probably a reference back that Benjamin's territory was right by the temple, right where God dwelt. And it says, and he shall dwell between his shoulders. Now, that's not clear what that means. You could have the image of a shepherd carrying a lamb on his, between his shoulders, over his shoulders, protectively, and that God protects Benjamin like that. Some have felt that since Benjamin was situated between two hills, that those hills are pictured as if they were God's shoulders, and the valley in between is where he dwells. There's no full agreement among scholars as to what is meant by that last line, but it's obviously intended to be positive. Now, of Joseph, he said, blessed of the Lord is his land, with the precious things of heaven, with the dew and the deep line beneath, with the precious fruits of the sun, with the precious produce of the month, with the best things of the ancient mountains, with the precious things of the everlasting hills, with the precious things of the earth and its fullness, and the favor of him who dwelt in the bush, meaning God who is in the burning bush. Let the blessing come on the head of Joseph and on the crown of his head, on him who was separate from his brothers. Now, by the way, that reference to him being separate from his brothers is actually something Jacob said about Joseph. When Jacob made his blessing on Joseph, he also mentioned he was the one who was separate from his brothers. So this is a line that's taken directly out of the earlier blessing on them. Everything else, although it's verbose and repetitious and long, is saying one simple thing. Let them be prosperous, really, with all the precious things that the mountains and the trees and the croplands can produce. Let him have a lot of favor from God and a lot of precious stuff. Then it says of him in verse 17, his glory is like the firstborn bull. His horns are like the horns of the wild ox. Horns, generally speaking, were a symbol of strength. In power, of course. Together with them he shall push the peoples to the ends of the earth. They are the 10,000s of Ephraim. They are the thousands of Manasseh. Now you can see that Ephraim had become much larger than Manasseh by this distinction. The 10,000s of Ephraim and the thousands of Manasseh reminds us of the song they sang in the days of David. Saul has slain his thousands. David has slain his tens of thousands. Obviously making David significantly more impressive than Saul. And Saul did not miss that. When he heard that, he could tell that David was a threat to him because people were seeing him more popular. Here, though Ephraim was the younger son of Joseph, and Manasseh the older, Ephraim was the one who became more prominent. And Manasseh became, like Reuben and like Simeon, became a very small tribe eventually. Now, notice that this blessing is on Joseph, and it includes Manasseh and Ephraim. They're not treated in this blessing as separate tribes, but as components of one tribe. And then verse 18, we have two tribes mentioned in one very brief blessing. And of Zebulun, he said, rejoice, Zebulun, in your going out, and Issachar, in your tents. They shall call the peoples to the mountain. There they shall offer sacrifices of righteousness, for they shall partake of the abundance of the seas, and of treasures hidden in the sand. Very difficult to know what this is referring to. Them calling people to the mountain to worship Lord. We don't know particularly if Zebulun or Issachar having a particular role like that. We are told in the book of Matthew that Zebulun and Naphtali were the tribal regions where Jesus began his Galilean ministry and were the first to hear and to come into the light. And it may be that some of the disciples of Jesus were drawn from those tribes. We don't know the tribal background of the disciples of Jesus. They were all Jews, so they all came from some Jewish tribe or another. Since Jesus began his preaching in that region of Zebulun, at least, not Issachar, but Zebulun and Naphtali, it's possible, but we could not say, that some of the disciples who later called the people to Christ to worship God, as it were, on the holy Mount Zion, the spiritual Zion, they may have been of the tribe of Zebulun. I mean, that's where Jesus drew a lot of his early listeners and stuff, and it could have included some of the apostles. But that's entirely speculation. It's not unreasonable, but it's speculation nonetheless. As far as them partaking of the abundance of the seas, these were landlocked tribes, and they weren't seafaring tribes. But it may just mean that they will have wealth and prosperity, and they can indulge in such things as are brought by ships from other lands. You know, they can buy them, and they don't go out by sea and get them, but the things, the abundance of the seas could come to them. But also the abundance of the seas could easily be a reference to the Gentiles, if it's taken symbolically enough. And the treasures hidden in the sand. Remember, God told Abraham his seed would be like the sand of the seashore? It's possible that the sand and the treasures hidden in the sand could be a reference to the remnant of Israel and the seas to the Gentiles. It may seem far-fetched, and if it does, don't credit it. But there is something to compare it with. And that is in Isaiah chapter 60, which is a reference to the Messianic age. And Isaiah 60 in the opening verses says, "Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord is risen upon you. For behold, the darkness shall cover the earth, and deep darkness the people. But the Lord will rise over you, and his glory will be seen upon you. The Gentiles shall come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your rising. Lift up your eyes all around the sea, for they gather together, they come to you. Your sons shall come from afar, your daughters shall be nursed at your side." And it says in verse 5, in the middle of verse 5, "And your heart shall swell with joy, because the abundance of the sea shall be turned to you. The wealth of the Gentiles shall come to you." The abundance of the sea will be converted. The wealth of the Gentiles, it seems that the sea here may be a reference to the Gentiles. And it's spoken in the time of a dawning light upon those who sat in darkness. It says that darkness will cover the land, deep darkness will cover the people, but the Lord will arise over you. Now, the statement is made to Israel in general. But if you look back at Isaiah chapter 9, a passage which is quoted in Matthew about Jesus, it says in Isaiah chapter 9, verse 1, starting in the middle of verse 1, it says, "The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, and afterward more heavily oppressed her by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan, in Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. And those who dwelt in the land of the shadow of death, upon them a light has shined." Now he talks about those who sat in darkness and a light shining on them. This is quoted in Matthew 12 as being fulfilled, or Matthew 4, excuse me, as being fulfilled in Jesus' ministry in Galilee. And it resembles Isaiah 60 about those who are in darkness and a light has shined on them, and the abundance of the sea will be converted to them, meaning the Gentiles. And so it's possible that this connection with Zebulun may be in fact a connection with the first converts to Christianity, where Jesus began his ministry in the realm of Zebulun and Naphtali, and possibly even apostles coming from there, and later seeing the abundance of the Gentiles converted through them. These ideas may be underlying the prophecy that Moses makes about these tribes here. Now verse 20, Deuteronomy 33:20, "And of Gad he said, blessed is he who enlarges Gad. He dwells as a lion and tears the arm and the crown of his head. He provided the first part for himself because the lawgiver's portion was reserved there. He came to the heads of the people. He administered the justice of the Lord and his judgments with Israel." All very interesting, but absolutely impossible to identify with anything later in the tribe of Gad, and therefore mysterious. Likewise, Dan, he said, "Dan is a lion's whelp. He shall leap from Bashan." That's all. That's all we get. Now, Bashan is essentially the region that Og had been the king of, and that Israel had conquered. Essentially, they were there at this time. They were in Bashan. They were in the region that included Bashan that they had conquered on the east side of Jordan. When it says he will leap like a lion from Bashan, it simply may be a reference to when they crossed the Jordan, the tribe of Dan will be like a lion leaping upon the Canaanites coming from the region where they now are. But it doesn't tell us anything else. I mean, all the tribes would be like that. It may be that he's saying, I can't say anything about Dan except what I can say about everybody else here. We're all going to leave here and go and leap over into Canaan and conquer it. But there's nothing really particular about Dan that this could be said to refer to. Verse 23, "And of Naphtali he said, O Naphtali, satisfied with favor and full of the blessing of the Lord, possess the west and the south." Okay, so this is just, again, a blessing on them and a mention of the region that they should inherit. "And of Asher, he said, Asher is most blessed of sons. Let him be favored by his brothers, and let him dip his foot in oil. Your sandals shall be iron and bronze. As your days, so shall your strength be." Now, Asher, it almost sounds like he's putting him above all the other brothers, but that didn't really ever happen. Asher never really became the prominent tribe at all. But he is saying something good about Asher, and that Asher should be respected by his brothers. And apparently, when it says let him dip his foot in oil, the idea would be he's so wealthy that he can, as it were, when he washes his feet, or soaks his feet, can use olive oil, which would be an expensive commodity. You would use olive oil sparingly because of its expensiveness, but if he can use it for washing his feet in, or anointing his feet in, it means he's got some wealth. He's got abundance of things that are expensive, like oil, that he can use them for such menial things as washing dirt off your feet or soaking your feet in. Certainly a luxury. And when he says, your sandals should be iron, your sandals should be bronze, your iron and bronze, okay. The idea seems to be that their sandals won't wear out. It's not like they're wearing leather sandals that wear out. They're wearing like iron sandals that don't wear out. That may not have a reference to them wearing out. It may have to do with their being able to tread upon hard surfaces and having extremely protective foot gear. It says of Christ that when he was revealed in Revelation chapter 1, he had feet like burnished bronze. And later yet in Revelation chapter 14, we find that he is trampling the nations like grapes, trampling the grapes of wrath, as it were, of the people. That is, his judgment is executed by his feet, and his feet are like bronze. That is invincible. And it may be that the sandals of bronze and of iron have that same connotation here. When it says in the end of verse 25, as your days, so shall your strength be. It's not obvious what that means, but it probably means that your strength will continue to the same extent that your days continue. That you will be strong as long as you exist, as long as you live. And I'm not sure if that's referring to the tribal destiny or to someone in particular in the tribe. Moses himself found that his strength lasted as long as he lived. As we see in the next chapter, verse 7 says, Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eyes were not dim, and his natural vigor had not abated. So, as according to his days, his strength was too. That is the idea that most people live longer than they remain strong. They become weak in their old age. But it seems to be saying that not so for you. Your days and your strength will be coextant. You'll be as strong as long as you are alive. There is no one like the God of Jeshurun, verse 26 says, who rides the heavens to help you. In his excellency on the clouds, the eternal God is your refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms. Famous expression, the everlasting arms. There's a famous old hymn, Leaning on the Everlasting Arms. That's from this verse. God's arms are seen as upholding his people. And his arms are everlasting arms. They do not wear out. They won't disappear. God will always be there to hold his people up so long as they remain in his arms, which is, of course, a choice they have to make. He will thrust out the enemy from before you and will say, destroy. Then Israel shall dwell in safety, the fountain of Jacob alone, in a land of grain and new wine. His heaven shall also drop dew. Happy are you, O Israel. Who is like you, a people saved by the Lord, the shield of your help and the sword of your majesty? Your enemies shall submit to you, and you shall tread down their high places. Now, since Moses had said some very negative things about their future, even in the previous chapter, he had said, I know you're going to be apostate. Perhaps what he's saying here is, despite that fact, in the immediate future is blessing and victory for you, because they are going into Canaan and they will have God helping them give the victory. And that's what these predictions, so many of them seem to refer to. Them going in, their enemies submitting to them, their enemies being crushed by them, them being protected from their enemies. A lot of these blessings have to do with relation to their enemies. And it's always good. In all these blessings, it's always positive. Your enemies will fall before you, will submit to you, you'll tread down their high places. But that's perhaps a prophecy of the immediate future. And maybe it's given sort of to counterbalance the long-range negative predictions that he made, so that they won't be totally discouraged. Now, chapter 34, then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo, to the top of Pisgah, which is across from Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land of Gilead as far as Dan, with all Naphtali and all the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, all the land of Judah, as far as the western sea, the south and the plain of the valley of Jericho, the city of the palm trees, as far as Zoar. Then the Lord said to him, this is the land of which I swore to give Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, I will give it to your descendants. I have caused you to see it with your eyes, but you shall not cross over there. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord. And he buried him in a valley in the land of Moab, opposite Beth Peor. But no one knows where his grave is to this day. Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eyes were not dim, nor his natural vigor abated. And the children of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. So the days of weeping and mourning for Moses ended after 30 days. And Joshua, of course, takes over. I might just say, this chapter as a whole bears the marks of being written by someone after Moses' time, for most predominantly because it mentions his death. And while there are some people who insist on making Moses the author of every word of the Pentateuch, and they would actually say that the prediction of his death was even made by him. He even tells about his own death prophetically, but there's no reason to do that. There's simply no reason to resort to that kind of a statement. After all, he would also be prophetically determining what portions of the land of Canaan were going to belong to Judah and Dan and Naphtali and Ephraim and Manasseh, because those portions of the land were not called that when Moses was alive. In verses 1 through 2, basically, it says he showed him the land of Gilead as far as Dan, Naphtali, the land of Ephraim, Manasseh, and Judah. Well, the land that he was looking at, they weren't called by those names in his lifetime. In fact, he didn't even know which lands would be, because that would be determined by the casting of lots after he was dead. he was looking at the land of Canaan, and a later writer, living after the time when the land was distributed, probably Joshua, wrote this and pointed out that the parts of the land that Moses saw, those were the parts that Ephraim and Manasseh and Judah and Dan later inherited and were named after them at a later date. But at this particular time in Moses' life, they weren't called that. So Moses would not be writing, giving those names of those places, because that would require that he would actually be anticipating where those tribes would settle before even Joshua would know. And even while they were conquering the land, they didn't know. That was decided after the land was conquered and lots were cast to decide who was going to go where. So obviously it's got the marks of a later writer using, speaking proleptically of these places by the names they later bore. And so Moses died and God buried him, and no one knows where he was buried. Why was that? They knew where Aaron was buried. They knew, everyone knows where David was buried. At least the people in Peter's day knew, because he said his tomb is with us to this day, David's tomb, but not Moses. It's possible that Moses would become such an icon to the Jews that his grave would have tempted them to become a sacred site where they would perhaps worship Moses at his tomb or something like that. It's possible that God anticipated that danger and therefore prevented that by not letting him know where he was buried. But it says in verse 9, "Now Joshua the son of Nun was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him. So the children of Israel heeded him and did as the Lord had commanded Moses. But since then, there has not arisen in Israel a prophet like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, in all the signs and wonders which the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt, before Pharaoh, before his servants, and in all his land, and by all that mighty power and all that great terror which Moses performed in the sight of all Israel." So the narrative kind of fizzles a little bit. I mean, Moses dies. Joshua takes over. We're ready now for the narrative that begins in the book of Joshua, where Joshua is in charge and they begin their conquest of the land. But there is this, in these last three verses, this statement that since Moses died, there has not yet arisen a prophet like him. Now, it's obvious that that is spoken from the standpoint of someone living some period after Moses died. It could be, of course, weeks after he died, although it seems strange to say weeks later. Just weeks after he died, we haven't had a replacement like Moses turn up yet in Israel. But years later, they might say that. It's interesting that it says that from whatever vantage point this last line was written, that there had not come a prophet like Moses. And of course, Moses had predicted in Deuteronomy 18:15 that God would send a prophet like himself. And the New Testament writers understood that prophet to be Jesus. And even before Jesus came, many of the Jewish rabbis considered that that prophet would be the Messiah, which is correct. But what's pointed out here is that there's not risen a prophet like Moses who did the signs and the wonders that Moses did, which reminds us of what we might not otherwise think. And that is that there were periods of time in Israel where God wasn't doing miracles. In fact, the seasons of no miracles were the rule rather than the exception. The seasons of miracles were unusual. As we read through the Bible, we read of God's intervention throughout Jewish history a great deal. But because thousands of years are compressed into a few chapters' time, we get all the exciting stuff. The miracles and stuff are certainly featured. But we might lose sight of the fact that there are long periods of time that there's no record of miracles, and probably none were done. The Old Testament was not a time sprinkled through with miracles. There were miracles concentrated at certain epochs, where certain seasons when God was doing something different. The establishment of the nation through Moses was a season of great miracles. The time of Elijah and Elisha, hundreds of years later, was a time of great miracles. Apart from those two times, there weren't a lot of periods of great miracles in the Old Testament. Then, of course, the establishment of the church in the New Covenant through Jesus and the apostles was a time of intensive, miraculous things. But we've covered 4,000 years, and there's been three seasons of intense miracle activity, which punctuated long periods of centuries where there was apparently no miraculous activity, and people's relationship to God was simply based on their obedience to His law. Now, since the time of Christ, seasons of miracles have come and gone. There have been revivals and then seasons of dryness. In some times in church history, there's been hundreds of years without a revival. But other times there's been a revival, almost several revivals in as many generations. The revivals usually are periods where there is miraculous activity, but the time in between is not. And so it's not really that much different since the time of Christ than it was before the time of Christ, except there certainly have been in the last 2,000 years more seasons of the miraculous than there were in the 4,000 years previous. But it simply raises the point that when you read the Bible, you may get the impression that God's just always doing miracles, and in a normal situation, you should be expecting miracles all the time. But that really isn't a correct way of reading the history, because the miracles were exceptions. They were usually done to signify that God was showing up to do something significantly different and to verify it with signs. As it says in the last verse of the book of Mark, that the apostles, whenever preaching the gospel, the Lord working with them with accompanying signs, confirming the word. So, you know, when God was sending out the gospel, and even now when He sends the gospel out to new territories, He often will confirm the word with signs. But at the time this was written, probably the time of Joshua, it was certainly after the conquest and the distribution of the land to the tribes, because the tribal areas are mentioned by name by the writer. Probably near the end of Joshua's life, this last chapter was written. And as Joshua was now probably near the end of his career, he could reflect back and say, you know, Moses has been gone for some time, and since he's gone, there hasn't been anyone like him that's come up. Nor would there, as it turns out, be anyone like him until Jesus would come. But that's anticipated by Moses and the prophecy he made. No one knew how long it would take at that time. We can see in retrospect it took 1,400 years for Jesus to come. But the things that happened in that 1,400 years remain to be considered in the historical books. Joshua, Judges, Ruth, the books of Samuel and Kings and Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. Those books are chronologically the next books to consider, which we will cover in the next module. Whether some of you will be there or not remains to be seen. But if so, I look forward to covering those with you.